Jim, take me back to the summer of 1966, when you and your research team in California invited a number of scientists into your lab and gave them LSD. What were you looking for?
We were determining whether one could use LSD in a moderate dose in a very safe setting to solve very difficult scientific problems dealing with the material world. This was not to have visions. This was not to have extraordinary music. This was simply to see if you could use the lens of a psychedelic to tightly focus down on a scientific problem that our scientists had been struggling with up to 3 months and had so far failed. So we were trying to get people who were very motivated to solve problems to try this new tool.
So this was an exercise in creativity to see if LSD could unleash people's creative powers.
Exactly. And we limited ourselves to hard science because it was generally known that artists were already experimenting with it, and that was interesting. But hard science is a much better way to determine if you've actually made a creative breakthrough or if you've simply had a good time and gone in a lot of directions.
Now, this was 1966, and this was actually government regulated, right?
Yeah, we had an investigational drug license from the Food and Drug Administration to use these substances both clinically and in this other way.
So you brought in a bunch of scientists.
We brought in senior scientists from a number of the local industries that were developing a lot of different products, and we also brought in some professors who were doing theoretical research. So we had problems ranging from Norgate theory, which is an abstract mathematical area used in circuit design, to space probes for solar properties, microtome improvements in tape recording technology. We also had some architects, and we basically said we want projects that your clients have consistently already turned you down with.
So you gave them, what, one dose of LSD?
We gave them one dose of LSD or mescaline, and we used them interchangeably. One dose, and then we gave them several hours of internal reflection with music and eye shades. And then basically we allowed them to go full bore on their problems. And to our delight with the first group, it went exactly as we said it would. And then from that point on, we simply were allowing people to participate. Because what happened is people would go back to their lab groups, and then we would get calls, can we also participate in this experiment? So it was a very pleasant and kind of genuinely exciting experience for these scientists. And all but two of our subjects had no psychedelic experience prior. So this was their only exposure.
So you're saying that one dose of LSD somehow allowed them to figure out, perhaps solve certain problems that they'd been struggling with for 3 months?
That was exactly the case. And the reason we wanted them to have struggled is we wanted them to be emotionally involved and to have emotional blocks by this time, meaning when the client's been mad at you for 3 months, when you're trying to earn a living and your supervisor is saying, are you making no progress? So we wanted problems that they essentially had been frustrated by, so that it, in a sense, upped the amperage of their desire to solve the problem. And solutions rolled out with amazing regularity.
After just one dose of
one
of
dose, they were given 3 to 4 hours, basically, of intense work. The comments from a number of them is the work was not noticeably better than their own good work, but instead of weeks, it was minutes. And that was, of course, extraordinary in its own right. And the other side of that is that we asked them several months later, had there been any residual creative effect? And what they said is, yes, that up to several months, and we didn't really ask beyond that, they had increased creativity, slowly diminishing back to their baseline. And the main way they were more creative is they were more focused. They were able to let go of solutions that weren't working. And the other thing, and this is peculiar to psychedelics, they were much more easily able to see patterns that they had not noticed before. So many of them said, I suddenly was able to take a totally new approach. And then I only later realized how interesting that in itself was.
So how do you explain this? What was going on in their minds?
Well, what seems to happen with psychedelics is that the self, the personality, the part that's frustrated or irritated or concerned, am I really smart enough? All those things are, they're lowered in intensity. And if you think about a problem for which you're capable of solving, in a way, all the information for the solution must be already present. But what you're blocked is finding it and putting it together in the right way.
So you kind of already know this, or somewhere, deep recess of your mind, you know the answer. You just, the question is how to access
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And a lot of creativity is this sort. Bach did not invent any physical objects, and Edison never did a lick of music. So you have rather specialized minds with a lot of different information, and it is that ability to access all of your information without any emotional blocks that seems to be the reason.
Now, one of the peculiar features of this story is that I know that while you were actually doing your research, you got a letter from the FDA saying, stop, this is no longer legal.
We got a letter from the FDA because we had a license to do this work, and they said to us and to 60 other projects that day, to be fair, that as of the receipt of this letter, your research is terminated. And our little team looked at this letter, and we had four senior scientists in the other room with headphones and their eye shades, the music going, and we were about to get them up to work on their problems. And I was very much the youngest member of the team, and I looked around at my colleagues and said, I think we got this letter tomorrow. And they agreed. We put the letter in the drawer. We worked with those last four people, and then we discovered the letter the next day. And the research was terminated. It was generally felt to be not a very smart executive decision.
Why was the research terminated?
Well, all the research in the country was terminated, including people who were giving psychedelics to mice, people who were giving psychedelics to bacteria. My own theory, and this is total speculation, is this was at the time when there was rampant, widespread use of psychedelics, which was fueling the anti-war movement, among other things. It was fueling upset in universities. Students were saying, we want an education. We don't want to be turned into parts for the factory. And there was a general questioning of a lot of the culture. There's also the civil rights movement. So there are a lot of people who are frightened by all these movements. And I think someone in Washington said, we got to stop these kids taking all these drugs. And everyone went, yes, yes, yes. And then someone said, well, who could we stop? And then someone, and I, if I knew who he was, I'd be angry at him, said, why don't we stop the researchers? We could stop someone. And I keep thinking someone said, that's a wonderful idea. We could stop someone. And so they stopped us all, which meant the information necessary for the young generation to not hurt themselves was also cut off at that moment.
But there had also been a lot of public attention to the misuse of psychedelics, and a lot of people say that Timothy Leary especially was to blame. I mean, he basically encouraged the irresponsible use of this, and some bad things happened to people who took these very powerful mind-altering substances.
Well, there's another way of construing that same history, which is if you actually listen to what Tim said, Tim actually eagerly promoted responsible use. And when he went around the country lecturing, and part of the lecture was, if psychedelics were legal, how would you take them? The hundreds of young people who showed up for such lectures were holding illegal substances and were going to take them. So in some sense, Tim is aligned, kind of maligned slightly by history. And Ken Kesey is not given enough credit for setting a model of the kind of behavior that just terrified the establishment.
Ken Kesey and his merry pranksters had been going around on their bus doing all kinds of crazy things, including taking psychedelics.
Absolutely. And in as public a way as possible. So there were lots of forces. There were all the bands who were using, but predominantly the fear in the establishment was not of young people hurting themselves, but of young people coming home and criticizing their parents' lifestyle and reasons for existing. And that, as you can imagine, is fairly terrifying.
Did you publish that study that you and your research team back did back in 66?
It was one of the last studies published. The creativity was published in a fairly obscure psychological journal. And since at that time, all media basically shut down their interest because obviously these substances being illegal, suddenly overnight, quote, no one was using them. So all the research stopped and we were one of the last papers published. I had a dissertation which was finished approximately in that same time, and basically the journal said, we can't possibly publish a study now which suggests that psychedelics might be useful, say, in the course of psychotherapy.
Now, you had your own personal history with this, right? I mean, actually, some years before that. I mean, you'd been a student of Richard Alpert, later known as Ram Dass, who, with Timothy Leary, did those famous studies at Harvard on psychedelics.
I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and Dick Alpert, who was an up-and-rising assistant professor, was my favorite professor, and I was one of his favorite students. We actually did research together one summer at Stanford. And after college, I ended up in Paris, feeling very much like I was pretending it was still the 20s and I was writing an extraordinarily bad novel. And he came to Paris and said to me, the most wonderful thing in the world has happened to me and I want to share it with you. Now, he was on his way to Paris with Tim Leary to join Aldous Huxley for the first public discussion of this research at an international psychology meeting.
What year was this?
This was 61. And here was my friend, the professor, and I was his friend, the student. And he says, best thing in the world happened to me, and I want to share it with you. And what are you going to say? So I said what anyone would say, well, gee, that sounds great. And he reached into his jacket pocket and came out with a little bottle of pills. And I looked at it, and I thought, what on earth is going on? I mean, I knew nothing about nothing. And I had a moderate dose of what was then psilocybin, and sat at a little cafe, and the colors got brighter, and the conversations behind me, I could hear them all clearly. And my French was quite poor, so I'd never been able to hear them clearly before. And I said, this is really just too much for me. And Richard Alpert said, it's really too much for me, too. And I haven't had any drugs. I said, why is it too much for you? He says, I've never been to Paris. So we retired to my room, and the beginning of my career change really stems from that night.
So that was a transformative day.
That was moderately transformative. And I then ended up a week later following this little crew to Copenhagen. And then I very soon thereafter came to Stanford as a graduate student. I was offered the alternative of going to Vietnam, and it had felt like psychology needed me more than the Army. And then I fell in with a small group with part Stanford professors and part people who were just funding it, and had a much more profound experience October 19th, 1961, in which my worldview truly underwent a serious transformation that is fortunately not recovered from.
What happened during that experience?
During that experience, I understood that there was an identity of some sort, which was larger than my personality, larger than Jim Fadiman. In some sense, the feeling of being connected to more rather than separated from more became predominant. And that separation, that understanding that Jim Fadiman was like a subset of my entire being. And if you think about it, your own personality, Alan Watts said it very beautifully once, which is 99% of me has never heard of Alan Watts. And so if you think about that, your identity is a very small part of your total body. I mean, what we now know is you have 10,000 species of bacteria and viruses inside your body, and there's more cells of them than there are cells of you. So the question of identity is still up for grabs. But in this case, my identity simply kept expanding and including more and more until it was clear that the way in which we construe time and space itself could be looked at as a subset. And so from that experience, and it's not an uncommon experience within the millions of Americans who have taken psychedelics, and when I came down and came back to being just Jim Fadiman, the graduate student at Stanford, it was a profoundly different way of holding my own identity, and it was is to not take it quite as seriously.
Hmm. And now, were you a graduate student in psychology?
I was a graduate student in psychology, and the psychology department had no idea what to do with me. What I did, because this was the hippie era, is I wore a coat and tie every day as a graduate student and tried to look as much like a kind of a hedge fund manager as possible. And I thought I would fool them. They would not know that I was dealing with studying Eastern mysticism and plant physiology from South America. And in a sad way, I can say I did fool them because of just simply by dressing conservatively.
And yet, on the other hand, here you were in a graduate program in psychology, interested in this really weird stuff, psychedelics. Well, and I would think that there might be kind of that might have been difficult.
Not if you didn't speak about it during psychology classes. At one point, I was doing a dissertation, and I had to have a committee. It took me 2 years to get a committee and about 10 weeks to do the dissertation. And at one point, the head of the American Psychological Association, or one of the heads, Jack Hilgard, basically looked across his desk at me as I asked to be on my committee, and he said, "You know you will destroy your career if you do this." And he had opened the first hypnosis laboratory in the United States and had taken a great deal of flack for that. And I said, "Jack, I deserve one chance to do something which may harm my career. You did it once. I should get at least that one chance." And he looked across the desk with this very grandfatherly, gentle, compassionate look and said, "Okay, I'll be on your committee." And I must say, in terms of my conventional psychology world, he was 100% right.
Meaning what? Your academic career was derailed?
Well, my academic career in any conventional sense was derailed. As it turned out, I actually have taught at San Francisco State University. I taught in Maslow's chair for a year at Brandeis. And I ended up actually teaching for 8 years at Stanford, but not in psychology. I was actually in design engineering, which is another long story for a different program.
But you also, I mean, you went on to help found this new field of what is known as transpersonal psychology. So obviously, you know, still in the sort of the rubric of psychology, but a very different way of looking at things.
Well, transpersonal psychology, simple definition, includes more of human experience than traditional psychology because it includes spiritual experience, which we know is a fundamental issue in every culture but conventional psychology. Conventional psychology has a rather atheistic history. So a number of us founded Transpersonal, which included these experiences we'd had with psychedelics, with meditation, the people who'd gone and worked with gurus in India. There was just a lot of human experience that we felt fairly obviously needed to be included. And so we founded, as one does, a journal and an association, and we had annual meetings, and those still go on. Mainstream psychology has still just begun to accept a lot of what we were doing. Certain things have gone mainstream. Meditation is not exotic. It's something that most physicians and nurses and psychotherapists learn to do, stress reduction, etc. Yoga is now not an exotic body twister from India. It's something that you look good in spandex and that you do, you know, as a kind of casual exercise system. The work with psychedelics underwent this long lull in research where the government basically said there are no exceptions to whatever rules we can think up. And in the last few years, that's really changed. And now we're doing very straight science and very rigorous science with these substances in ways that much of which is repeating the 60s research, you know, kind of better design. But a lot of it is truly novel, and we are moving forward. So it is a very exciting time to, in a sense, I feel like a kind of retired CIA agent that's, "We're bringing you back, Jack. It's just one more job." "No, man, I don't want to do any more of that." "But, Jack, this is your sister, and she's been kidnapped, and she's in Kurdistan." "Okay, I'll join you for one more job." So I'm back.
Now, we were saying this was the mid-60s when you were doing this. Height of the Vietnam War. Counterculture was in full force. You were hanging out with Ken Kesey, right?
That's true.
So you were a counterculture guy yourself.
Well, I had this wonderful bicultural, so to speak, or multiple personality perhaps. But by day, I was a graduate student at Stanford. And by night, I was a serious psychedelic researcher. And on and off, I was also very peripheral to the Kesey world. My wife actually had been dating Ken, and this is before she was my wife, definitely. So I was a very marginal member of that much more exploratory and exciting kind of side of things where they didn't know what they were doing and took enormous risks. We didn't know what we were doing and were very, very careful.
So, I mean, take me back to Ken Kesey's world for a moment. What was he doing that made an impact on American culture?
Well, two things is he wrote one of the major American novels, which I see endlessly on the high school reading lists, which is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which, after all, is simply a novel about altered states of consciousness and how they interact with reality. And that came directly out of his own psychedelic experiences and his very, very considerable talent. His social world, his kind of charismatic bus world, with a group of people who basically flocked around him for very far out adventures, such as driving across the country in the kind of bus where the police stopped you just because they didn't know what else to do. And then someone would leap off the bus and put a microphone under the policeman's nose and then start broadcasting whatever he was saying, basically kind of frightening the whole system. Ken, I think, had a saying that he wishes to walk along the road tearing up the fence posts as he goes. So he was what you might call a chaotic explorer. And that had an enormous impact on, really, on the arts. And he also, the first light shows, which are now kind of very standard, the first light shows were developed to support something called the acid test, which Kesey and the group and a little-known band, which later became known as the Grateful Dead, put together. Hmm. So if you add the Grateful Dead and Kesey as... what did they do for the culture? And the answer is they opened up a great many parts of it without any structure, without kind of knowing what happens next. It's a little like Pandora had the same problem. She knew that opening the box was going to be exciting. She didn't know on the whole it would make trouble, and there were a few things left in the box worth having.
So what was your role, your niche in this experiment that Ken Kesey was part of?
Well, I was the kind of person who they said, oh, look, he's very strange. It was as if I was someone who ate light bulbs and could chew on glass. And you say, he looks straight, but look, he bites light bulbs. Well, they would say he does look straight, but he's doing legal psychedelic research, which in their world was an extraordinarily far out idea to do, that one could actually stay within the law and work with these substances. That for them was fairly extraordinary. So I would say I was a tolerated marginal member of an enormously exciting, culture-busting adventure.
And then something strange happened to not only that culture of the 60s, but more specifically to the public acceptance of psychedelics. I mean, basically it went totally underground. It was banned by the government. Research on it, which had been thriving not only in this country but in other countries in the 50s and the 60s, that disappeared for decades.
Well, let me frame it in a way that rather heightens the absurdity, which is at the time the government stopped our research, LSD was the single most researched psychiatric drug in the world. When I joined the research team, I wrote to Sandoz and said, has anything been published? And I got two huge volumes only of abstracts, and it was the first 1,000 studies. This is at the same time where the United States government said by fiat, by decree, by Moses coming down from the mountain, that as of the date of our letter, there is no known medical use or therapeutic use of LSD, and it has considerable potential for abuse. Now, this is the reading of what's called Schedule 1, and many, many substances are on it, so LSD wasn't being singled out. It was as it was put on that schedule. So at that point, you take one of the most promising psychiatric drugs on the planet and you ban it. And thousands of people have already used it. And it can be made by diligent chemists. And since it's potent in micrograms, it's one of the most powerful substances ever discovered biochemically, you have set yourself up for an explosion of use. And one of the chemists...
Even an explosion of use if it's illegal.
Well, the fact that it was illegal, a lot of people said, well, does my government tell me the truth about everything? And once you get the obvious answer to that, then you say, well, maybe I should find out from people who have personal experience rather than a government pamphlet. And the personal experience people said, seems okay to me. And just the fact of the matter is, since LSD became illegal in the United States, and this is now the U.S. government figures, at least 24 million Americans have taken LSD. And that figure goes up fairly regularly, 400,000 to 600,000 each year. Now, these are forms the federal government gives out. And imagine that you're given a form and said, would you please check off which illegal activities you have done in the last month, in the last 6 months, in the last year? My feeling is that might lead to underreporting. So, but given, as I say, the U.S. government figures, it's about 24 to 25 million people, and predominantly the more educated. So if I'm talking to judges or to prosecutors or to scientists working in, say, NASA, there's a fair percentage of them that will have had considerable psychedelic experience, often in college, and those are the people now who are running the culture. So it is a peculiar situation where there's the underground is vast, extensive, well-educated, and for many decades really didn't communicate very well with each other. Most of that is changing now.
Well, and then there's another piece of this history, which is going back to your creativity study with the scientists in the 60s, it turns out that a number of well-known scientists and designers and tech people took psychedelics. I mean, Steve Jobs has famously said LSD was one of the two or three most important experiences of his life. There are other stories as well. I mean, there's an argument that actually psychedelics had a big impact in the founding of Silicon Valley.
Well, it's not an argument. It's merely a checklist. But what we do know is that a number of heads of corporations in Silicon Valley use psychedelics in this way, not in the somewhat safe, secure, therapeutic, you know, setting with trained people, but that they used it with the intention of looking at technical problems. We know that Carrie Mullis, a Nobel Prize winner, who developed recombinant DNA that we see in all the legal cases, that came, he says, directly from his use of psychedelics. He did not have the great insight while on a psychedelic. He makes that a point. But he had learned how to get inside a molecule and look around. And that is what led to this discovery. So also there's some controversy, but it's highly likely that Crick.
Francis Crick.
Francis
of
Crick
double helix
of the double helix. But he would have been Francis Crick of the single helix, we think, and there are some articles. But he took a low dose, similar to our study, really, about that much, and from that envisioned not a single helix, but all of a sudden, with the enhanced visual an imaging capacity common with psychedelics, envisioned a double helix. And as we say, the rest is history. So if we look at Steve Jobs and we look at Crick and we say, in terms you were asking about Kesey's influence on the culture, it's much more interesting to look at Jobs and Crick and Mullis in terms of what they've done for the culture. And so we're seeing that psychedelics actually, not only that, but it led to almost all of what we're interested in brain chemistry. Out of the study of LSD came this fascinating substance called serotonin. And anything you read in neuroscience, within about two sentences, serotonin has appeared.
Wait, explain this. What's the connection between LSD and serotonin?
Well, you're going to ask me a question for which chemical diagrams would be appropriate, but I couldn't draw them anyway. Basically, when you're studying LSD, one of the questions is, what does it affect? What happens? Particularly since LSD is in micrograms and actually leaves the brain before the main effects have been completed. And one of the things that turns out is that serotonin and dopamine, these two up and downers of personality and creativity and many other things, are what is affected. And when we get to something like MDMA or ecstasy, then we're talking much more about serotonin being expressed more fully and then at the end of an evening being depleted. LSD is a little more subtle, and there's a wonderful paper on the mechanism of LSD, and it says, we looked at 1,000 papers, and we really don't know. And I thought, oh, good, we're even. I haven't read 1,000 papers, and I don't know how it works either.
So we were talking earlier about your research back in 1966 when you were 27 years old. And let's skip ahead nearly half a century. You're now in your 70s,
right.
One of the wise men of the well, psychedelic movement. And remarkably, there is a resurgence in the scientific interest of psychedelics at a handful of universities around the country.
Well, there's a resurgence partly because of those 24 million Americans. And most of the people I know who are the senior researchers who are running these projects, when they usually entered, in this case, mostly medical school, that was their intention. That's what drew them into medicine in the first place, is their own experiences in high school or in college, where they said, there is something incredibly interesting happening here. Science must be allowed the freedom to discover how the world is made. That should be one of the basic human freedoms. And here was this area where he said, well, you can't use this tool. I mean, imagine going into the laboratory in bacteriology and they say, here is a hand magnifying glass and over there is an electron microscope, but you can't use it because it might be dangerous. And you say, but how can I look into the structure of things if you're only giving me the most primitive tool? And the answer is, here's the government regulations, we didn't make them. So these people were naturally frustrated because these are remarkable scientists who've dedicated a number of years of their career to look into the core of reality, perhaps. And so eventually the people who passed the laws in the 60s passed away. So there's a little secret in science that quantum mechanic Max Planck had a comment when asked about the acceptance of his theory. He said, my theory will be accepted, gentlemen, when my colleagues are dead. And what he was saying is it's hard for a generation that has grown up on one theory to give it up for one that is more open, that is more complicated, that is more comprehensive. We talk paradigm shift. There's other words we use. What's happened with psychedelics is that there's already this kind of underground, vast sea of experience. And now it's relatively easy to translate that into research. A number of the research projects, for instance, say volunteers wanted must already have considerable experience with the material. So we're basically assuming there's a pool of highly educated, in the words of Jimi Hendrix, experienced people out there who are more than happy to help researchers fine-tune discoveries. And there are some also remarkably exciting discoveries that have been made and will affect really the public health system of this country for many years.
Like what? What are the most interesting discoveries that have been made?
Probably the most interesting right now is use of a substance that's not quite a psychedelic, but classed along with it in the popular mind, which is ecstasy, is the popular word, MDMA. And it has been used to overcome the enormous problems suffered by people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. And the research is startling and heartwarming, where people who have basically been incapacitated for years and likely to become drug addicts or alcoholics as to kind of cool down the pain, with several MDMA sessions as part of a total therapy program, recover, if not completely, vastly so that they can get whole full-time jobs, that their family likes them again, that they can love again.
So why? I mean, what changes in their minds to allow them to be highly functional again?
Well, ecstasy has a peculiar effect, which it allows you to feel your feelings without being frightened by feeling them. So you can revisit that which disturbs you the most. Let us say you've come back from Iraq, and it isn't that you've been fired on. That's not what causes post-traumatic stress. But you've been driving your Humvee, and in the road in front of you are three children playing. And your officer says to you, keep driving. It may be a trap. And you kill them. That's trauma. And it's unforgivable trauma. It's the deepest wiring in the human being about that you don't go against your deepest moral codes, even in war. And so you don't want to think about that. And you can't help it. You know, you can't help having the nightmare of running them over again and again and again and again and again. With MDMA, you can look at that, and you can look at it and understand it wasn't your fault, it wasn't your officer's fault. It wasn't the children's fault. It might have been a trap. And that the terribleness of it can be fully experienced without shame, without guilt, just as fact. And that in itself turns out to be a moment of intense liberation. And from that letting go of the trauma, or the trauma is of being raped, or of child abuse, or of having some terrible car accident in which, say, your parents are killed, and you've just been yelling at them and distracting them, and all these years, you don't know if you did it. That kind of terrible trauma seems to be able to be let go of. It isn't forgotten, it isn't denied, it isn't repressed. It's simply accepted as a terrible time in your life that doesn't have to run you from that point on. Now, put that against 700,000 returning vets with post-traumatic stress disorder, and the other treatments are of minimal to zero help. Now, for some, that isn't quite true. There's a certain percentage that are helped by psychiatric drugs and therapy, but there's this huge pool of the deeply hurt and the deeply wounded who are young, who are not especially well-educated, and who either are going to be an incredible burden on the culture for the next 50 years, an endless source of huge billions of dollars through the Veterans Association, or maybe we can help them. That keeps a lot of researchers pretty excited.
Well, you're painting a picture of miracle drugs here. I mean, whether it's dealing with PTSD or addiction, we could also say there are interesting studies along there, unlocking the mind to unleash our creativity. These are also incredibly powerful substances. I mean, misused, I mean, they can kill people.
Well, what we know is that when the when penicillin and all of its little family were discovered, that was the term that was used. These were miracle drugs because here were diseases that had been the scourge of humanity for as long as we had a history and before, that suddenly could be cured. Syphilis, which was a horrible killer of many, many people in Europe, a lot of famous people that we both know of died of syphilis. Suddenly it's, oh, you have syphilis here, take this, and in 10 days... I don't think you'll need a refill on the prescription. That's a miracle. The psychiatric drugs, when they first came in, the Valium and Prozac and so forth, miracles. So in a sense, medicine is this this delightful area in which miracles are what you make a living off of. That here is a drug that will keep you alive and you would have died and so forth. So the psychedelics, in a sense, are more mental miracles, biochemical miracles, but they're just substances and they affect bodily systems and mental systems. So it's not as much of a leap as you might think.
You've also been an advocate recently of what is known as microdoses of some of these substances, LSD and some other things. I mean, basically tiny, what, almost imperceptible amounts?
That's actually the term. Is they're called a sub-perceptual dose, which is less than you would notice. Which is a peculiar way of talking about these substances. But the psychedelics are things that you really notice when you have them. And as one person says, when you have a microdose, the rocks don't glisten even a little. And so that's approximately a tenth of what people take perhaps to go to a concert. And what we're finding is that there are uses for this. One is it doesn't bother anyone and it doesn't bother the culture. So you can take a microdose and go to the bank and be a bank manager or be a physician or be a rock musician. And what you will find at the end of the day, and these are mainly written reports being written around the country to me, I had a really good day. Things went better. I was a little nicer. I was a little kinder. I ate a little more healthy. I did another set of reps at the gym. My kids didn't bug me, even though they did the thing that bugs me. So it's not a major event. Now, there are some possibly exciting possibilities that we're just beginning to look at. And just in the last day or two, I've been getting messages from someone who suffers from what is called an ice pick headache. The cluster headaches, which are the worst known headaches, are kind of big lumps of time where you're in torturous pain for 20, 30, 40 minutes. An ice pick headache is the same level of pain, but it's 20 seconds to maybe a minute. And they also come in clusters. Well, someone who was experimenting with microdoses felt one of these terrible, terrible pains coming on and took a microdose. And within about 15 minutes, the headache dissipated. And during the next 2 days, she was reporting the awareness of a headache starting. And then in one of her emails to me, it said, and poof, it dissipated. And the level of happiness and excitement of not Because when you have these, you know you are in for X amount of time with intermittent, the worst pain that we know of. And to have this microdose, this almost nothing, make a difference. This is the research I'm doing, which is really asking people, do you have any experience with microdose with any of the psychedelics? And I get reports on various ones. And I'm now interested in moving towards specific conditions, and this particular case is moving me much faster in that direction. So you're really catching me almost in mid-stride with excitement about what microdoses may be for. Now, also, the person Albert Hofmann, who developed LSD and who later synthesized psilocybin, indicated that this microdose area was under-researched and that he felt it could be very easily a replacement for things like Adderall and Ritalin, which we know have side effects which are far worse than the side effects from microdoses. So far, the side effects from microdoses have not yet been mentioned, except some people say, I get a little too emotional, so I stop doing it.
Do you see the government easing up on the regulation of these things? I mean, basically making some of this stuff legal, at least in a clinical setting?
Well, they are making it in a sense when you're allowed to do research on a medical condition and you report that the medical condition has been vastly improved, you're setting the government up to do what it's supposed to do, which is to review the evidence and to say, well, that was a small study. Would you do a larger study? And it's where there are what are called phases in medical research. And the third phase is when it's done at many different sites, so it isn't the bias of the experimenter. MDMA is just about at that point. And after that, under the way the government is set up, it then becomes available to whatever subset of the medical community is appropriate. And in the case of these substances, it will also take people who have specific training. It's a little bit like even if you're a physician, you can't just order a vial of radioactive, say, thorium. You have to be certified that you know what you're doing and you're not going to kill yourself or other people. And so psychedelics will be more along those lines. And there are problems. The FDA really hasn't figured out quite what to ask for in some of the studies. But we're helping them. They're helping us. And unlike during decades past, there's generally goodwill in the federal agencies and a tendency to force researchers to do jump through three or four times as many hoops as with more conventional pharmaceuticals. And of course, once the pharmaceutical industry finds out that there is potential profit, let's say in something which turns around depression in 20 minutes instead of 6 weeks, and there is a substance for which that ketamine, that seems to be the case, then you will have all the muscle of the pharmaceutical industry, the pharmaceutical lobby, and then maybe not under the highest moral reasons, the rules will change.
You know, listening to you, it strikes me that you are still the counterculture figure here. Maybe not in the same way you were in the 60s, you know, when you were hanging out with Ken Kesey, but you're still, jousting with the establishment.
Well, I would no longer say I'm counterculture. I am asking of the mainstream culture, of which I'm a member. I'm married. I have kids. I have grandkids. You know, I pay for the streets and sewers, and I vote. And I try and eat better. I'm not that interesting. But the culture now, with all those millions of people who have shared experiences such as the ones I've described, are not resisting. The fascinating thing to me is when we do the smallest, most uninteresting little psychedelic study that is put in one of those obscure, we can write an article so dull about even the Second Coming, you wouldn't read it twice, those journals. The press goes wild, and there are hundreds of references to the research, and none are negative. That's the thing that is quite fascinating. There's something happening in the culture that is not yet understood by the legislative branch, and that is that these substances are no longer seen as terrifying. They're seen as very powerful, but so's your automobile. So's your electric lawnmower, but you don't then, jail people for wanting to use them. So the culture has changed, and it is a kind of a grassroots change. So I'm actually probably more Even in the psychedelic world, I'm considered somewhat right-wing because I think people should use these only if they know what they're doing. Now, if I said people should only drive cars if they know what they're doing, everybody said, well, that's not right-wing. Well, it used to be. And then we have licenses. You had to be licensed to drive. It's just a machine. You get in it. You click the key. It goes forward. I mean, why do you need a license? Well, we've evolved to the point where we can see that it helps people not get hurt. And so I think what we're moving toward is a kind of user's license for psychedelics, which is, do you know what you're doing, or are you not going to hurt yourself or other people? And that's another possible legislative way. Also, other countries are doing it other ways. The other countries are no longer basically saying, I have to do everything the United States does or they'll hurt me. So Portugal, for instance, everything is legal. Now, what happened? Oh, all the things that the naysayers were terrified of. Use of every psychedelic has gone down. Use of hard drugs has gone down. Use of cocaine, heroin. Hospitalizations have gone down. People going into treatment has gone up. Why? Because the government says you're allowed to get treatment for what used to be illegal. So we're seeing, here's a perfectly normal European country that says, let's change our drug laws entirely away from the United States model. And really, I think we're all amazed as how sane and grown-up people, police, hospital systems, judicial systems can be. Now, people are still arrested for crimes in Portugal, but they are not stealing to support a drug habit for which now they can get treatment.
This is all quite fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.